that someone had been outside my kitchen window, it would mean that someone could have raised the screen, could have come into my apartment. Carmine's interruption was welcome.
"Time for our reveal,"
he said, leading me back to the styling chair. He turned it away from the mirror so that I faced Rhonda. Again, the gentle fingers worked on my head, and again I closed my eyes. I felt the chair spin.
"How do you like it?"
I opened my eyes as I heard Rhonda's soft, "Ooh," and echoed it myself.
"I love it," I said. "Absolutely love it." I really did, too. The length was good, the curls were tamed, the highlights were subtle.
I still looked like me, but way better. Carmine efficiently cleared away the hairstyling paraphernalia and made a neat row of bottles, boxes, brushes, pencils, and tubes.
"Makeup now," he said. "We begin with the wonderful green eyes."
I tried to watch the process, thinking I could learn from the master, so to speak. But he moved so fast, wielding brushes both broad and narrow, mascara wands, two kinds, liquid and powdered foundations, it was all pretty much a blur. He made a grand final flourish with a brushful of bronzer, then stepped back, tilted his head, leaned in, and adjusted one lock of my hair, stepped back again, and pronounced me perfect.
"Wow, Lee. Wait till Pete sees you now. I mean, wow."
Rhonda stood behind me, gazing at my reflection.
"Perfection," Carmine said. "I've wanted to do this since I first saw you on that psychic thing you used to do."
"Thank you so much, Carmine," I said. "This new look is just what I needed tonight. A real confidence booster. What do I owe you?" I accepted the hand mirror he handed me and admired myself from every angle.
"This one is a gift from Mr. and Mrs. Doane," he said. "But if you'd like me to make it a regular appointment, just let me know."
"You'll be hearing from me," I said, holding the hand mirror close to my face. We'd had makeup people on the home shopping shows I'd done, but the results hadn't been this spectacular. I handed him a more than appropriate tip and looked at myself in the hand mirror once more.
Big mistake.
The flashing lights, the whirling colors are even more intense on a small surface. I knew I was about to see a vision. I didn't want to see it, but couldn't look away. No more glammed up Lee Barrett. Instead, I saw the face of another woman. I recognized her right away. Bridget Bishop. She smiled directly at me and lifted one hand. In her palm, she held two bullet casings. Then her brown eyes turned black, black and beady. She turned into a crow before my startled eyes. The vision blinked off, and once again I saw myself. Rhonda's words seemed to come from a distance.
"Come on, you can admire yourself later. Let's go see how you look with your outfit on. I hung it up in the dressing room. Let's go."
I put the mirror face down on the marble counter, picked up my handbag with my notes in it, and hurried to catch up with Rhonda. The dressing room hadn't changed much since I'd last seen it. A rolling clothes rack, a couple of mismatched tables, a brown vinyl-covered club chair and hassock, a vanity table with a mirror surrounded by round light bulbs. I avoided looking into the mirror and looked instead at the clothes rack. My garment bag was the only one on it. Rhonda unzipped it and handed me the soft jade-green silk dress.
"Thanks, Rhonda," I said. "I'm glad you're here with me."
"Wouldn't have missed it," she said. "Did you bring shoes to go with this?"
"They're in the bottom of the bag," I said, as I pulled off my sweatshirt, being extra careful not to mess up my hair, and unzipped my jeans. "I think they'll only be shooting from the waist up, but I bought new shoes anyway."
Holy crap, Lee, Rhonda said. Are these Jimmy Choo's?
I admitted my extravagance. Couldn't resist.
Well, get dressed. Let's see how you're going to look. You'll be on in less than an hour.
Surprised, I checked my watch. All that fussing with hair and makeup took longer than I thought. I slipped into dress and shoes, then did a slow turn for Rhonda.
What do you think?
Take a look in the mirror, she advised. See what you think. I didn't want to look into that mirror, or any mirror.
I can't, I said, picking up my notes. I'm too nervous. I'm going up to the newsroom now. Do I look okay?
Definitely okay. The newsroom buzzed with the usual hour before broadcast activity. When I entered the room, Buck Covington was already seated in the anchor chair, sipping on a Coke and chatting with one of the lighting men. Marty McCarthy was my favorite camera operator, and I was happy to see that she was part of the crew for my debut. I recognized, but had never met, the current audio engineer who sat in front of an intimidating, to me anyway, bank of screens and control panels. The station's field reporter, Scott Palmer, was there behind the glass pane, too, in the news director's usual seat. Bruce Doan likes to get as much work from every employee as he possibly can, and it appeared that he'd found an added duty for Scott. Heads turned in my direction as I walked to the half-circle of red and black laminate that formed the anchor desk. A panoramic view of Chestnut Street, sometimes called the most architecturally perfect street in America, provided the background shot.
"Hi, Moon," called Marty.
I'd been Crystal Moon, psychic, when we'd worked together.
"Looking good," she said.
"Darn good," offered Scott.
"Going to tell us all about the crows?"
"I'm going to try," I said, pausing in front of the anchor desk. "Hi, Buck. What's the plan? Do you call me up here during a break?"
He turned on that million-dollar smile.
"Right. What time does Lee come on, Scott?"
"Lee gets 14 minutes at 11:31, right after the shopping mall commercial. You'll do the teaser for A Murder of Crows at 11:27 and the one-minute intro at 11:30. I have the crow videos ready to roll. Then we go to Weather with Wanda on the green screen, sports roundup at the desk, and close. Got it?"
Buck wrinkled the perfect brow for a second and consulted a printed schedule. Big smile.
"Got it."
"Come on over and sit by me, Lee," Scott offered, patting an empty chair next to him. "You can help me direct this party."
I accepted and shuffled through my notes for the 100th time that day. Scott put a restraining hand on my arm.
"You don't have to look at those now.
You know the material, and the teleprompter has all the bullet points you sent over. Just relax. You're going to be fine."
Scott's not one of my favorite people, but sometimes he's right. If I didn't know the material by now, I was in the wrong business. I stuffed the notes under my chair and watched the opening credits for the nightly news roll. Chapter 30. Once the on-the-air sign lit up and the theme music played, my nervousness melted away, and professional show host, weather girl, call-in psychic Lee Barrett took over. Well, maybe not that last one. Anyway, I was able to focus on Buck Covington's words, Scott's hand signals, the multiple screens facing the broadcast tech, and, most of all, the studio clock. The WICH-TV late news runs from 11 to midnight. Then comes Tarot Time with River North. I wondered if Therese was in the building, if I'd have time to ask her about the previous night's interrupted phone call. No time for that just then. Although 15 minutes out of the news hour doesn't seem like a long time, when those minutes have to be filled with your own words, accompanied by appropriate facial expressions, when you know you must not cough, scratch your nose, or say anything inappropriate, those minutes can seem like a very long time.
Buck read, flawlessly, of course, an entertaining piece about the Dragon Boat Festival on the Charles River, then switched to a more serious note with a report on the increase in arrests for local vandalism. He gave a brief update on the Christopher Rich case, describing the finding of two spent bullets in the back wall of the magic shop. There was a brief clip of Rich himself describing his ordeal. A touching segment on Megan's funeral included Scott Palmer's earlier interviews with some senior citizens who told about Megan's cheerful weekly visits to area nursing homes. Buck did the teaser for A Murder of Crows at 11:27, and during a commercial for Liberty Tree Mall, I took my seat beside him at the anchor desk. At 11:30, Buck turned on the megawatt smile full blast.
I'm honored to introduce a brand new feature here on WICH-TV. Tonight, our own Lee Barrett takes over as investigative reporter. She'll be joining us occasionally this summer, presenting in-depth facts on topics the community may find puzzling or even troubling. Something that has puzzled and troubled all of us lately, Lee, is the phenomenon you call a murder of crows. Tell us about it.
I took a deep breath, smiled, turned on my own carefully cultivated on-air voice, throaty and a little bit sexy, and began my new career. Thank you, Buck. I'm delighted to be with you tonight. Let's discuss what we've all been talking about for a couple of weeks now. Crows. Thousands of them. So why do I call this a murder of crows? That's a real ornithological term, and it comes from a time when groupings of many animals were known by colorful and poetic names. How about an ostentation of peacocks, a parliament of owls, a knot of frogs, or a skulk of foxes? With the help of the bullet points on the teleprompter and some well-placed and prompted questions from Buck, I led the viewers through much of what I'd learned about the strange springtime roost of what the United States Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Service estimated to be 20,000 to 30,000 birds. Most of the crows have been noticeably absent for several days, I said. They may have broken up into smaller groups, but there's a strong likelihood that they may reorganize, and plans are in effect for the use of more fireworks, spotlights, and perhaps electronic recordings of crow distress calls. I made it clear throughout my talk that these methods wouldn't harm the birds. We showed the stripped apple tree, and I repeated Mrs. Bagenstos's touching story of the blossoming branch her late husband had cut for her. When the video of the crows stripping Gloria's quince tree came on screen, I talked about Gloria Tasker's famous quince jelly. Mentioning the witch connection was unavoidable, but I kept it to a minimum. Some have associated the deaths of several members of Salem's Wiccan community with a sudden appearance of the crows, perhaps because crows and witches often appear together in folklore and paintings. The crow has long been associated with magic and the power to manipulate physical appearances. I touched on the bird's reputed penchant for carrying off shiny objects. Many experts agree that even though stories about crows stealing rings and coins persist, there isn't much evidence that this is true. Hey, Mr. Expert, I know of one that probably carried off a couple of shiny bullet shell casings. I closed by noting that scarecrows were beginning to reappear around Salem, with a reminder that the birds are protected under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Buck thanked me for the informative and interesting report, hoped I'd be back again soon, then asked, off-script,
"So you think the crows will be back?"
"I think they're already on their way," I replied. Cut to Wanda the Weather Girl, and my debut performance was over. Buck Covington shook my hand. Marty gave a thumbs up from behind her camera, and Scott offered a fist bump as I passed his chair on my way out of the newsroom. Rhonda had waited for me on the other side of the window. "You were great. Looked fabulous, too, even though your shoes didn't show. Didn't you see River and me waving at you through the glass? She's gone downstairs.
Time for her own show.
She paused for breath.
Is it true about the crows? Coming back, I mean.
Sorry I didn't see you in the window. Those lights are too bright. And yes, I think with everything I've been able to learn about them, the crows will be back.
It sounds like you know a lot. Hey, can you believe that Chris Rich getting his face on the news again for free? What a mooch.
What do you mean?
Oh, he's such a publicity hound. Only he never wants to pay for airtime. He calls here every other week trying to get us to cover some event he's having at his store.
She shook her head.
I wouldn't be surprised if he shot those holes in his wall himself just to get on TV. Well, gotta get downstairs. I'm sure I'll be seeing you around here a lot.
Maybe it wouldn't be surprising if he'd made an anonymous phone call to River, threatening his own life.
Thanks, Rhonda, I said. I sure appreciate your being here for me tonight. By the way, is Therese around?
Nope, I'm screening. Therese has an early morning video shoot.
Gotta run. See you.
I wished her a good night and headed downstairs to the dressing room to pick up my jeans and sweatshirt, thinking about what she'd said about Christopher Rich. The idea that he might have fired those shots hadn't occurred to me, but there were no witnesses, so it was possible. Making a sneaky phone call was possible, too. I'd surely ask Pete what he thought about it. And I'd also like to know what he thought about Sean Madigan being at the Baginstow's house.
Yeah, I'll ask him about those things, right after I figure out how to explain those shell casings in a sandwich bag on my kitchen counter.
Pete's car was already in the driveway when I got there. I pulled into the garage, parked the vet, grabbed the garment bag, locked everything, and hurried past the garden toward the house. The sensor lights along the path glowed just enough to illuminate the smiling, pink-faced scarecrow standing among the flowers and vegetables. Somehow, the silly face on the thing, so friendly and happy in my aunt's kitchen, had a sinister aspect in the silent, after-midnight darkness. I didn't linger to look around for cats or crows, but dashed up the back steps and into the welcome safety of home. Pete had left the hall and stairwell lights on for me, and Orion waited just inside the door. After dropping off the bag with shirt and jeans in the laundry room, and with the cat trotting ahead, I climbed the stairs. Pete greeted me with a warm hug and a kiss that promised more, then held me at arm's length with a long, appreciative up-and-down look.
"You're beautiful on TV, lady,"
he said, pulling me close once more, his voice sexy husky.
"But you're a thousand times more gorgeous in person."
I did a little twirl, something like the one I'd seen Claudine Baginstow do.
"Like the new look?" I asked, knowing for sure that he did.
"I like,"
he said. Taking my hand, he led me down the hall to the kitchen.
"Let's celebrate."
As soon as I stepped into the room, I felt a rush of tears.
"Oh, Pete, it's wonderful."
And it was. The room glowed with soft candlelight, and a vase filled with red roses shared space on the table with a bottle of champagne icing in a silver pail, two champagne flutes and a bowl of my favorite treat, chocolate-dipped strawberries, completed the loving picture. Thoughts of crows and casings almost disappeared as Pete, with a courtly flourish, held my chair, then, sommelier-like, popped the cork on the champagne. He poured the lovely bubbly into our glasses, then raised his in a toast.
"To Lee, and a bright new career in television."
"Do you really think so, Pete?" I asked as we tapped the flutes together. "I hope I'm good enough. I know I have a lot to learn about reporting, but..."
"Shh,"
he said.
"I recorded your program. You just watch it, and you'll see for yourself. You're good enough. The way you spoke about the crows almost made me like the damned things. Here, have a strawberry."
I sipped my champagne and took his advice about the strawberry. Two strawberries, actually. Glancing across the room to the long granite counter, where a few more candles glimmered, I saw a corner of the plastic sandwich bag peeking out from behind the sugar bowl. I knew we'd have to talk about it soon, and I could tell that Pete wanted to put that moment off every bit as much as I did.
"More champagne?"
he asked, as I licked one last bit of Belgian chocolate from my lips. I put a hand over my glass. "No, thanks. This was a wonderful celebration, Pete. The roses, the champagne, the strawberries, the candles. It's all perfect, and I love you for it. But we do need to talk about those shells, don't we?" He nodded.
"We do. How about I put some coffee on, and we go into the living room and you can tell me all about where they came from. Okay?"
"Okay," I agreed, still not sure of what I was going to tell him, not sure of how I was going to tell him. So much of it didn't make any sense, even to me. Pete turned on the overhead lights, and together we snuffed out the candles, put the few strawberries that were left into the refrigerator, and rinsed out our glasses. Then, with a cup of decaf in one hand and the sandwich bag in the other, I followed Pete down the hall to the living room and reality. Chapter 31. Orion snoozed in the zebra print chair, barely blinking as we entered the room. Pete and I sat side by side on the couch, our cups and the bagged shell casings on the coffee table in front of us. I was the first to break the silence. "You know that I see things in unexpected places," I began.
"I know."
His tone was sympathetic.
"Did seeing things have something to do with these?"
He gestured toward the shell casings. "Yes, at least I'm pretty sure it did."
Do you want to tell me about it?"
I nodded. Something left them on my windowsill." He frowned.
"That would mean someone was on the fire escape. I don't like this, Lee."
He began to reach for my hand, then paused. The frown grew deeper.
"What do you mean, something? Something left them on your windowsill?"
"Maybe."
"Come on, Lee. This is serious. I've told you before, you can tell me anything. I'm not judging you, not doubting you. You need to tell me exactly what happened."
His voice slid into cop mode.
"These shells..."
He pointed to the bag.
"These shells may be evidence in an attempt on a man's life. That's serious business."
"Rhonda thinks Chris Rich might have shot the bullets into his shop wall himself, for publicity. I'm even wondering if he made that phone call to River."
"Rhonda may be right. Maybe not. We don't know. We don't have a weapon yet. And we've sent River's phone tape to a police lab for voice analysis. If it was Chris, we'll find out. But I need to know what you know about these shells. I need to know now."
He took my hand and squeezed it.
"Please trust me, babe."
"I do trust you, Pete. I do. It's just that these damn divisions complicate everything. Sometimes I don't know what's real and what's not." I fought back tears. "Okay, here goes." I blurted out the whole thing, barely pausing for breath. I told him about the crow shadow woman I'd seen in the yard, and about the crow on the fire escape dropping the shells onto the outside sill. I tried to describe how the crow's face had turned into a woman's face, and how the same woman had looked at me from the hand mirror at the station. I reminded him that I'd seen visions in window glass before, and he'd been with me when I'd seen one on the TV screen, so he knew that the surfaces where the things appear had evolved over time. "Whatever I saw from the window," I cautioned, "might not have been there. I mean, the shells were there. You have them in your hand. But how they got there, I don't know." He looked worried.
"Then it's possible that someone real, could have been out there on the fire escape sometime during the day. That would mean that they'd have managed to pull down the escape ladder that goes from the second floor to the ground."
"Yes, I've been thinking about that. It's supposed to be foolproof. Guaranteed. Aunt Ibby said so, and you know how she is about security." He stroked my hair, looking into my eyes.
Jesus, Lee. I worry about you.
I had no answer for that, and the tears started again. Orion left his chair, climbed onto my lap, and gave my cheek a friendly lick. That made me smile. I'll be okay, I promised. I'll keep the window locked until we're sure the escape ladder is secure.
Good idea. Now what about the woman you keep seeing? Do you know who she is?
I think so, but you're not going to like my answer.
Try me.
Bridget Bishop, I said, speaking very calmly. Well, the ghost of Bridget Bishop. He stopped stroking my hair and leaned back against the couch cushion.
You mean the old witch that's supposed to haunt the Lyceum?
Yep, but now she's haunting me. He couldn't help smiling at that idea.
Wow. Listen, maybe I can tell the chief that somebody figured out how to climb up on your fire escape and put these shells there without mentioning crows.
Well, a bird really could have dropped the shells there, you know. They're shiny and small enough for a bird to pick up and carry. Anyway, they might have nothing to do with whoever, whatever, shot at Christopher Rich.
True.
He took a couple of sips of coffee.
But didn't you say that the experts don't buy that story about crows? We don't have a weapon yet, anyway. I'll just take these along and put them in the evidence locker for now.
Wait, Pete, I said. Another odd thing happened today. He raised one eyebrow.
Odd how?
I saw Sean Madigan again. Instant cop voice.
You did? Where?
He was at Claudine Bagenstos's house. I ran into him just as I was leaving. He wasn't very nice.
What did he say?
It was almost like a warning. He said, "This isn't a good place for you to be."
Hmm. You don't have any reason to go back there, do you?
I hadn't given that any thought. Now that you mention it, I guess I don't.
Okay, then. I wouldn't worry about it.
That's Pete. He knows how to make the complicated into the manageable. An unknown somebody, or maybe a bird, left two unidentified shell casings, which may or may not be important, on my fire escape. And an unpleasant encounter doesn't have to be repeated. So lock the window and stay away from the Bagenstos house. Seemed simple enough. I felt better. Thanks, Pete, I said. I love you. I'm still worried about River, though. Will you tell me what you find out about that phone thing? That brought a hug.
We're on it. Don't worry. I love you, too. Want to see yourself on TV now?
We watched my 15-minute segment of the news together. I was happy with my performance, and pleased with the way I looked, even though nobody saw my new shoes. It had been a very long day for both of us. We finished our coffees and shared a couple of white chocolate-covered strawberries with sprinkles. Pete locked the kitchen window and promised to check the fire escape in the morning. I didn't glance at the glass panes, and even took off my sensational new makeup without looking at the mirror. Not an easy thing to do, but I didn't want to risk seeing any more crows or witches, real or imagined. Pete didn't lose any time the next morning in carrying out his promise to check the fire escape.
"Think your aunt will be awake by now?"
he asked.
"I'm planning to go out this window, down to the one at her level, and see if the drop-down ladder is secure. Don't want her to think there's a stranger outside."
He lifted the window sash all the way up. The cool morning breeze was pleasant. The sound of crows cawing in the distance was not. I tried to ignore the noise and glanced at the Kit Kat clock. She's probably in her kitchen on her second cup of coffee, halfway through the globe crossword. I'll call her to be sure. She picked up right away. "Good morning, Marilee. You were wonderful last night, and you looked so pretty." "Thank you. I think it went well. The reason I'm calling so early, Pete is going to check on the security of our fire escape. Just wanted to warn you that you might notice a man outside your window shortly." That would certainly be a surprise.
A note of hesitation.
Why? Does he think there's something wrong with it? Is it unsafe?
No, not that. I signaled to Pete that it was all right to climb out the window.
I'll explain it all later. You did tell me that the contractor guaranteed that no one could climb up from the ground, didn't you?
Her absolutely was indignant.
I wouldn't have installed it if it wasn't positively intruder-proof. Anyone would have to have wings to get to the second level.
That's exactly what I thought in the first place. Wings. Crow's wings on a shape-shifting witch ghost.
I know you're right. Pete just wants to be sure I'm safe up here. Love you. We'll talk later. Bye.
Poking my head out of the window, I watched as Pete slowly descended the metal stairs.
I sneaked a peek at the maple tree. A few crows, not a lot of them.
I focused on Pete. He seemed to be inspecting every rung.
When he reached to the second floor level, he pulled a transparent bag from his pocket, a blue adhesive strip at its edge.
I've hung around Pete long enough to recognize an official evidence bag when I see one.
Chapter 32. Pete saw that I was watching and gave a little wave with the hand holding the bag. In the other, he held his evidence-gathering tool. He calls it a Swiss Army knife on steroids. It has pliers, both regular and needle-nose, wire cutters, assorted screwdrivers, a lanyard, can and bottle openers, a file, and a wood saw.
I've missed a few gadgets, I'm sure, but you get the idea.
Within the grip of those pliers, and about to be dropped into a plastic bag, was something Pete had found on my fire escape. All I could tell at such a distance was that it was small and red. He dropped the bag into his pocket and moved slowly, deliberately toward the end of the platform where the drop-down section of the escape ladder was secured. Kneeling, he took a photo of the assemblage, then stood, turned, and scrambled back up to where I waited. I moved away from the window while he climbed inside. He brushed dust from his jeans and pulled the plastic bag from his pocket.
"What do you think of this?"
he asked, placing it on the table.
"Looks like you had a visitor out there after all, but that ladder clearly hasn't been moved since it was installed."
The realization that there'd been no two-legged guests at my window brought a wave of relief.
"Thank God,"
I whispered and quickly sat down. I reached for the bag, recognizing the small red collar with its silver buckle right away.
"The little black cat," I said.
"She's not the first of Orion's lady friends to come to the window. Impossible for a human, easy for a cat." I inspected the bag, turning it over in my hands.
"You don't have to take this, do you? It doesn't look as though the collar is broken. It must have just slipped off. I'll put it back on her neck, if she'll let me."
"You can keep it," he said. "It doesn't seem to have anything to do with the shell casings."
I removed the collar and handed the bag back to Pete. "Can you reuse this?"
"Nope. Contaminated. Might have fleas,"
he joked. The mood in the room had become much lighter. I put the bag into the recycling bin, carried the collar into my room, and placed it carefully into one of the secret compartments of my bureau, and returned to the kitchen.
"Haven't any witnesses to Chris Rich's story turned up at all?"
"You'd think somebody would have heard the shots, or have seen someone behind the magic shop," I said.
"Not much is new. We've identified the last two customers who were in the shop before he closed up that night, though. Caught them on surveillance video as they left the store."
"Two people together?"
"No, one at a time. We've asked each of them to come and fill out some information for us. Maybe one of them saw something."
"Anyone I know?" I asked, half-kidding.
"Don't think so. One of them is Victor Protector, last guy you'd expect to see in a witch shop."
"He's protesting a tax increase now," I said. "Buck showed a clip on the news tonight. Who's the other one?"
"Just an amateur magician. Rich says he's a regular customer. Calls himself Fabio."
"The fabulous Fabio," I said. He's doing Shannon's wedding cake. Pete gave a questioning look but didn't comment on the magician-slash-baker.
Guess I'll get ready for work, babe. You have any special plans for the day?
Not exactly. I need to decide what my next investigative report is going to be. I plan to ask River if it would be possible for me to do a report on the Wiccan funeral rites. Not the public one we just did at Town Hall, the real one.
I'm guessing they probably keep that stuff pretty secret, he said. Better think of a plan B.
I've also been thinking about what becomes of stolen masterpieces. Want some breakfast?
Nope, not enough time. I'll grab a sausage biscuit on the way to work. I hope you're not thinking about interviewing Madigan, are you?
Not really, I said. Just a passing thought. Maybe I'll do an in-depth investigation of the wedding planning business. I'm right in the middle of that one, and the wedding is on the 21st.
Got my invitation. What should I send for a gift?
Just like it says on the invitation, they're asking for contributions to the fund for repairing broken tombstones in the old cemeteries.
That's easy. I don't have to wrap it. The invitation says I have to wear black or white. Does that mean a tux?
Not if you don't want to, I said. Just black slacks and a black shirt will do. We have time to figure it out.
Well, let's not worry about it this weekend. 2 whole days off. I've got tickets for the Sox and the Angels for tomorrow night. Sound good?
Sounds perfect. I kissed him goodbye and turned on the kitchen TV. Mr. Doan had said they might use a shortened clip of my report on Good Morning Salem. Call me vain. I wanted to watch it again. Someone had done a good job of editing the piece, hitting the most important bits, and using the best visuals. The quince tree stripping sequence was the most dramatic part, downright eerie. I hoped once again that the poor tree would recover and provide more quince jelly for any future tenants of Gloria's cute house. I studied my on-screen appearance, too, more carefully than I had when Pete was with me. Carmine had done a darn good job. I knew Aunt Ibby would be curious about the outcome of Pete's morning stroll on the fire escape, and I wanted to talk to her about my recent scrying episodes. Even though Pete had managed to make me feel better about the things I'd been seeing, I was still filled with questions and dread. I needed my aunt's calming wisdom and felt lucky that she was just a couple of flights of stairs away. With Orion a few steps ahead of me, we took the back stairs. I tapped on the kitchen door, and the cat barged right on in through his cat door. "Come in, Marilee," my aunt called. "It's unlocked. I've been expecting you. What was that commotion on the fire escape all about? Come in here and tell me everything." "That's exactly what I came here to do," I told her. "It may take a while. I've had a busy couple of days." "Pull up a chair, my dear. Have you had breakfast?" Without waiting for an answer, she filled a cup with fragrant hazelnut coffee and put a fresh, still-warm corn muffin on a plate. She put the butter dish and a bowl of her homemade strawberry preserves within easy reach, then sat opposite me, fairly quivering with expectation. "What's going on?" "Where to begin?" So much had been packed into 24 hours. I started my story with my visits to the Tasker and Bagginstow's households. Gloria's cousin Jane was very nice. Showed me around the house. It's really cute. Did you know Gloria didn't own it? Rented it, I guess. I didn't know that. I've never been invited over there. Again, that little sniff. But then, of course, I wouldn't be. What do you mean? I get the feeling you and Gloria didn't get along. Oh, dear. Is it that obvious? I may as well tell you, then, now that she's dead and gone. Slight pause. She looked down at her hands. Once, while you were living in Florida, I became engaged. That was a shocker. Engaged? You? I gasped. Well, you needn't act so astonished. I'm not without some sort of appeal. I'm sorry, I didn't mean... She waved a dismissive hand. Never mind. I know what you mean. Anyway, Gloria deliberately set her cap for him, outright seduced him. I gave back the ring. She promptly dumped him and moved on to her next victim. She sighed. I've never quite been able to forgive her, even though she's dead. She gave a shrug of her shoulders and a grim smile. And poor River thinks she had bad thoughts about Gloria. She should see inside my head. Even though I've known her all of my life, my aunt continues to amaze me. I didn't know exactly how to respond to this latest revelation, so, without comment, I proceeded with my own story, saying the first thing that popped into my head. Jane has a dog named Zeus, I said, and she has a cat back in Nevada. She says she didn't know Gloria well at all, but she's the closest living relative Gloria had. She inherited all the personal belongings, and she's packing what she wants to take home. She offered me a pretty teapot, but I have no use for it. Did she know about the video her neighbor took of the Quinn's tree? She did. Apparently the whole neighborhood knows about the nosy photographer. Jane thinks her cousin must have been the subject of more than one video. My aunt made a tisk-tisk sound. Bertha Barnes is a member of my library book club. I didn't know she took her photography hobby to that extent. I wouldn't like to have anyone knowing what's going on in my own private space. Like having crows and cats and God knows what else looking in your kitchen window. Jane said that Mrs. Bagginstose dropped by to express condolences, I suppose, and they compared notes on the damage to their trees. That's how I learned about Mr. Bagginstose's last gift to his wife, a spray of apple blossoms. Nice story, wasn't it? It was. Did you give Claudine my regards? I did. She's quite attractive, isn't she? She was wearing an exquisite lace dress from the 1920s, and somehow it looked just right on her. Yes, she has an amazing wardrobe of beautiful clothes spanning at least a century. Inherited most of them from her great-grandmother, I've heard. Everything was black. The woman was widowed young, like you were, Marilee, and wore black for the rest of her life. I seem to be surrounded with little black dresses lately, I said. Shannon's black and white wedding, River's black velvet gown, Claudine's flapper dress, the woman in my vision. Oh, yes. Tell me about the vision woman. Have you figured her out yet? I haven't figured her out, and I know it's important that I do. It sounds nutty, but I believe she's Bridget Bishop. It was Aunt Ibby's turn to act astonished. Bridget Bishop? Why on earth would you think that? Was it time to share the truth about that cursed spellbook? The truth I'd kept secret for so long? I wasn't sure. I hesitated. Can you, just for now, trust that I have good reason to think so? I asked. Of course. She reached across the table and patted my hand. I have faith in you always, Marilee. But can you tell me what the woman in the vision was doing? Perhaps I can help to figure it out. I guess I have to back up and tell you about the shells. Seashells? No, shell casings. From bullets. A crow put two of them on my windowsill. How do you know a crow did it? I saw him put them there. She nodded, as though that made sense. I see. Is that why Pete climbed out the window? Sort of. They're the same caliber as the bullets they dug out of Christopher Rich's wall. Pete was worried that a person left them there, a person who could get inside, could get to me. She gasped. Oh, no. Go on. It was my turn to pat her hand. No, it's okay. He checked. No one has been on the fire escape except a cat. She lost her collar there. She assumed what I call her wise owl look. A red collar. Was it the small black cat? Yes. I'm going to try to put it back on her if she'll let me. It's not broken. Must have slipped off. A black crow, and then a black cat, she murmured. That's right. You've been seeing Bridget Bishop dressed in black. I imagine you believe there's a connection between the three? It was a relief to hear someone else, especially my aunt, put that thought, that knowledge, into words. Of course I do. Bridget Bishop is, or was, an extremely powerful witch. She had special methods.
Spells?
Special spells. Yes, and according to the old witch trial records, Bridget Bishop used animal familiars. Quite a variety of them.
I know, said my librarian aunt, who knows a lot about everything. I remember reading that she used a black pig, and some sort of strange monkey with the feet of a bird.
She cocked her head to one side. I wonder if that's where the idea for the flying monkeys in the Wizard of Oz came from. I must ask Rupert. A witch needs to find an animal willing to work with her, or him, I said. River says a witch can ride a familiar. That means she astrally projects into the animal and can see through its eyes. I remembered how the eyes of the woman in my vision had changed into crow's eyes, and shivered at the memory. Call me crazy. I believe Bridget Bishop was on my fire escape, first as a crow, then as a cat. There, I've said it out loud.
I'd never call you crazy, Aunt Ibby said. Have you told Pete any of this?
No. I mean, I've told him about most of the visions, but have I told him I really think a long-dead witch is peeking in my kitchen window? Not exactly. Chapter 33. As well as I could, I brought Aunt Ibby up to speed on what was happening in my life. I told her about the brief encounter I'd had with Sean Madigan outside the Bagginstoses' garage.
You say his car was parked inside the garage? As though he was part of the household?
I wouldn't go that far, I said. I mean, poor Mr. Bagginstose is barely a few weeks in the grave, or rather, in the urn. His ashes are on the mantelpiece next to the pink vase Claudine used for the apple blossom branch he cut for her.
I didn't mean that kind of part of the household, dear. Certainly not. Not Claudine. But Mr. Madigan does have a background in fine art. I wonder if she's consulting him about Elliot's art collection.
She paused, looking thoughtful.
And regarding the poor man's ashes, I wonder if she's aware of the witch tradition about going back to the earth. I'm sure that must have been Elliot's wish. Perhaps someone should tell her.
I sure wouldn't volunteer for that, I said. I think I'll take Madigan's advice and stay away from there.
Is that what he said to you? How rude.
That's not exactly what he said, I admitted. He told me it was not a good place for me to be.
Does Pete know about this?
Yes, he seems to agree.
Wise old owl look back in place. Perhaps you should take the advice, then.
I intend to. I'll move on to other things.
Any bright ideas for the future investigative reports? The crows appear to be gathering again, she said. I imagine you'll be called upon to follow up on last night's report, with some in-depth information on how to get rid of them for good. Humanely, of course.
You're right. I suppose they'll use fireworks. That'll be a great visual. Everybody likes fireworks, except crows, apparently.
You should definitely include scarecrows, too. How do you like mine?
Theodore is magnificent. Maybe I'll interview you for a brief tutorial on how to make one.
Let's look outside and see how he's doing. I'll bet there aren't any crows in my garden.
Orion was way ahead of us. As soon as Aunt Ibby uttered the word outside, he scooted across the room and out the cat door. By the time we opened the door to the yard, he was at the garden gate, grooming his whiskers. My aunt was right. There were no crows in her garden. Even though the branches of the oak, the maple, and the chestnut trees were dark with them, iridescent blue-black feathers glistening in the morning sun, raucous voices caw-cawing.
"See?" she said, sounding almost gleeful. My scarecrow works just fine.
Could be, I said.
But maybe it has something to do with the large yellow cat. Orion, his tail straight up like the plume on a drum major's hat, patrolled up and down between the rows of plants. Between the Scarecrow and Orion, maybe this little plot of earth is safe from those rascals, she said, looking in the direction of the clamoring crows. But from here it appears that the city is in for another Corvus invasion, just as you expected. Afraid so. I think I should call River later today. This might be disturbing for her. I remembered how thoroughly frightened my friend had been by the crows after they'd first appeared in Salem. She seemed to think that somehow it was her fault they were here, and that was in addition to blaming herself for the deaths of the three witches. Poor River. I hope she's come to realize that witchcraft has nothing to do with either circumstance. I hope so. She seems almost like her old self lately, and she certainly looks wonderful. Have you seen Tarot Time lately? I caught the beginning of her show one night, when she was wearing the black velvet dress we talked about. Stunning with the red corset. She looked great in it, didn't she? But did it remind you of the clothes they say Bridget Bishop wore? Good heavens! You're right! Did River dress that way on purpose, do you think? We headed back toward the house, but Orion maintained his pacing in the garden. I don't know, I said. I haven't asked her about it. Maybe I will. Maybe I will. Someday, when all this is over. Aunt Ibby went into her kitchen. I thanked her for my breakfast and climbed the curving staircase to my apartment and to my own kitchen, with a big window opening onto a fire escape. I'd always thought of that sturdy platform with its ladders to safety as a comforting presence in my life. Now I didn't even want to look at it. I'd told Pete I'd be working on ideas for future investigations for the show, and I fully intended to do it. I put the laptop on the kitchen table and began by listing possible topics. 1. Methods of dispersing crows. 2. In-depth study of wedding planning. 3. Theft and forgery of paintings. I'd already accumulated the general information on the methods other places had used when a murder of crows had descended on their cities. An interview with a pyrotechnics expert would be good. I could probably get an appointment with the mayor, too. As for the wedding planning, thanks to Shannon and Dakota, I already had contacts there. What about 3 on my list? If I decided to do it, and that was a big if, a study of famous art heists would come first. One of the biggest, the robbery at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, tops the list and is still unsolved. If I did it right, maybe even the big Boston TV stations would cover it. It could even go national. Whoa, I'm getting ahead of myself. Back to the cherry bombs and bottle rockets. I opened the folder I'd started earlier on crow dispersal methods. The point of all of them is to make the crows uncomfortable enough to get the desired result. Make them move someplace else, and do it without harming the birds. Is Bridget Bishop trying to make the witches of Salem uncomfortable enough to get what she wants? The return of her spellbook? Is she harming witches in the process? Or is that someone else's doing? I was having a hard time staying focused on my duties as an investigative reporter. I kept mixing the job up with the other things on my mind. Things like the dead witch and cats and crows, and a dead man in the gazebo, and the art thief I'd soon walk beside at a wedding on a beach, and black dresses. Way too many black dresses. Time to take a break. Refocus. I closed the laptop, pushed my chair back, stood and stretched. I faced the window and wondered if Orion was still assisting the Scarecrow, performing crow watch in the garden. I lifted the sash and looked down. Yes, Orion, that noble beast, still proudly walked his new self-imposed beat. So far, so good. I saw no crows in the yard, although I still heard a bunch of them chattering in the trees. I caught a flash of motion close to the edge of the window.
There, approaching on dainty paws, was the black cat, sans collar. At just about the center of the wooden frame, she placed two front paws on the outer sill and looked up, straight into my eyes. I heard an unfamiliar female voice. "Do you have it?" I couldn't tell where the words came from. Not from inside the kitchen, yet not from the outdoors either. The voice is in my head. Am I crazy after all? "You know what I want." The cat's eyes held mine. I looked away to where Orion paced, robot-like, between the green rows below. "Yes, yes," I said aloud. "Wait right here. I'll get it." I hurried to the bedroom, hands shaking as I pressed the button hidden in a carved curlicue on my bureau. A compartment popped open, and I picked up the red collar. The cat now sat on the sill. I put the collar on the table and lifted the screen slowly, carefully. Was it really a cat, or was it a vision? I put a tentative hand forward. If it was a vision, I shouldn't be able to touch it, to feel its fur. The idea that the thing was real was even scarier than the possibility that the whole thing was in my imagination. It was real. I felt behind me for the collar, fumbling for it, not taking my eyes from the cat's eyes. "Hurry," the voice commanded. The cat stretched its sleek head toward me. I placed the scrap of red leather around her neck and secured the silver buckle. With the briefest nod in my direction, she darted to the top of the ladder, where Pete had so recently made his cautious way down to the second-floor platform. She paused for a few seconds, then with a graceful leap landed just outside Aunt Ibby's window. With one last soaring bound, she alighted in a cushioning patch of rosemary. Lifting those delicate paws one by one, she approached Orion. He turned, facing her, with his head down, front legs outstretched. He bowed. Chapter 34. I closed the window against the increasing volume of rasping crow noise, and once again sat at my table. I opened the laptop and stared at the blank screen. What the hell was that? Had I had a conversation with Bridget Bishop? I was pretty sure that was exactly what had just happened, and I didn't like it one bit. We have to give the damned book back. Then she'll go away and take her crows with her. But how are we supposed to do it? Megan, the beautiful, smiling Megan, appeared on the screen almost instantly. I smiled back at her, knowing, hoping, believing she would answer the question. Of all of the images this strange ability of mine had produced, hers was the most welcome. "Can you show me how, Megan? Please show me how." Even as I spoke, I had faith that she would. I was pleased, too, that she wore blue, not black. The screen assumed a smoky, misty look. It was like the crystal ball in my dream. When the haze cleared, I saw a beach. It was nighttime, with no moon at all, but a glow of firelight illuminated the scene. As I watched, a procession of black-robed men and women, one by one, approached a blazing fire. More black. I frowned, but leaned forward, trying to memorize every detail. A woman at the head of the line held something with both hands. A few of the people following her were veiled or masked. I knew that those were witches who kept their involvement in witchcraft secret. There were 13 of them altogether, and as they formed a loose circle around the fire, I seemed to move closer. I recognized the leader as River, and the item in her hands was an urn, something like the one I'd seen on Claudine Bagenstos's mantle. Megan's ashes? Of course. But how was Bridget Bishop involved? The focus changed again. As the fire and the witches receded into the distance, a starkly white shape stood out against the nighttime beach. I recognized the gazebo right away. It was the same graceful structure where I'd seen Christopher